is a writer and a researcher who lives in Nashville, Tennessee, where it's been raining cats and dogs. His primary expertise and mission is the recovery of ancient technology and mythology for the purpose of closing the gap between Earth and heaven on Earth through the raising of spiritual vibration and increasing spiritual vision. In 1984, while working toward a degree in music business at Belmont College, a life-altering dream awakened his intuitive understanding. One morning, he returned from, in quotes, dreamland with a medical condition, which he cares not to discuss. Seeking to understand this medical impossibility, he switched his field of study to psychology, physics, and the brain-mind connection. He parlayed his intuitive understanding and undergraduate study into a position as special projects researcher at the Subliminal Research Foundation in Albuquerque, New Mexico. They're working with a team of psychiatrists and psychologists. He specialized in the holographic paradigm, investigating the brain, mind, subliminal, or hyper code. This gets very interesting. He holds a trademark for Makeup for the Mind, a pioneering idea for self-image enhancement for women. He designed and produced Bright Images, best-selling 3D subliminal audio tapes. And then, after tiring of fighting to explain how we can positively be affected by message or energies that are not perceived consciously, he sought a new, less new agey field of study. In 1989, he attended the first International UFO Congress in Tucson, Arizona. At last, he had found a discipline whose validity was beyond question, or so he thought. Convinced the ET factor is real, he has passionately investigated extraterrestrial involvement in human affairs ever since. Today, William is considered one of the new breed of researchers who stand on the shoulders of such giants as Sitchin, Van Doniken, Hancock, the guy I'll be on the cruise with. In 1997, his book, The Peacemaker and the Key of Life, was published. Now get this. It is the first book to uncover the myths and prophecies of the peacemaker, the herald of the Christ or Messiah. Wow. William Henry, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, sir.
Great to have you. You have gone through a very interesting sort of shift in your work, and you began in the subliminal messaging area and kind of gave up on that, according to this. Is that correct?
Yes, I did. I gave up on it in part simply because the market fell off on the products. People were very into subliminal tapes in the mid-80s. The brain-mind machines were beginning to come online, and people were starting to look to these sorts of technologies for self-improvement. And then all of a sudden it vanished, and I think it had a lot to do with that Judas Priest case. As you might recall, there were a couple of teenagers that committed suicide after listening to a Judas Priest tape that was...
Yep, absolutely. You know what? There's a new headline running today.
There is.
That does not involve backmasking or subliminal messaging, but rather forward lyrics, just regular lyrics that it is being suggested caused a suicide.
Right.
And how do you react to that? I mean, both in the Judas Priest case, even in this case, people are now suing. And they're suggesting that lyrics in songs, forward or reverse, are causing people to do things. How do you react to that?
Well, you know, the word is the power, and we have to choose our words carefully. We can cut like a knife with our words, or we can create a world of peace and harmony. It's up to us.
Well, are you suggesting then that you believe that words do have those kinds of consequences, that people who say words that cause other people to take what might be considered to be irrational actions can be held legally responsible?
I have a feeling that there's such a thin line between freedom of expression and mind control. And a lot of these folks do cross that line into mind control, where they are directly manipulating a person's brain and they're willingly doing this. They know they're doing it. And that needs to be discouraged.
Do you believe that subliminal messaging works?
I do believe subliminal messages work, yes.
Mm-hmm.
There's a billion-dollar, multi-billion-dollar industry based on it called advertising.
Yeah. Well, there's advertising and there's advertising. There's telling Art Bell straight out on the screen in the middle of a football game, have a beer, have a Coke, whatever it is. And then there's subliminal advertising, which apparently would endeavor to take one frame or one very quick thing that I can't see or can't hear and put it in the middle of the football game, causing me unconsciously, unwittingly, to want the product. Right?
Correct.
Now, I talked to I had a guest on the other night who said that that all of that kind of thing is still going on en masse. Do you believe that?
Oh, it's everywhere. I don't look for it as much as I used to, because, as a matter of fact, it's become so, it's the norm anymore. Everywhere you look, we're just in a sea of energy, of images and energies that are attempting to manipulate us to do one thing or another.
Okay, well, if subconscious suggestion really works and we are inundated with it, then how are we to know at any given moment that our thoughts are our own?
That's a very good question. I mean, that's part of the reason why I expanded my focus away from the subliminals. The holographic paradigm, which you mentioned there, allows for that. It allows for higher dimensional energies, voices that may be ours, that might be coming from another realm altogether, which can be from an audio source in a room beside us, that these messages can have an effect on us. And, in fact, they do have an effect on us.
All right. Well, I'm very uncomfortable with that. I don't like that one bit, you know, thinking that my own thoughts are not what they are. Anyway, you left all that because there didn't seem to be anything you could do about it. You believe that somebody is coming, let's see, how can I put this? That there is a presence coming to Earth in the form of, I guess, a human being, though I need to ask about that,
okay,
who will precede the Messiah or the return of Christ. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Tell me about it.
Okay. The peacemaker is the herald or forerunner of the Christ or Messiah. And in my work, what I have done is found this figure appearing in every culture and civilization, from Atlantis to Egypt, among the Mayans, even a couple of times in America. And by being able to isolate the various appearances of this figure, I was then able to go into the various mythological traditions as well as prophetic traditions of these cultures and retrieve the prophecies concerning the return of this figure. There are preachers all around the world on Sundays that talk about the second coming. And there's thousands of books that have been written about this so-called second coming, but this is the only book in existence, to my knowledge, that has ever looked at the prophecies of the absolutely crucial figure in that event, the one who is the ambassador who comes in and introduces the show, so to speak.
Is there some biblical support for all of this?
Oh, certainly. Elijah in the Old Testament was labeled the peacemaker, and John the Baptist, according to Jesus, was the reincarnated Elijah. Therefore, John the Baptist was the herald, forerunner, or peacemaker.
But I'm talking about biblical support for the suggestion there will be one who comes before the second coming.
There is, but it's in code. In the book of Revelation, in chapter 19, it says, "Behold, I saw in heaven open, and behold, a white horse. and he that sat upon him was called Faithful and True. In my book, The Peacemaker and the Key of Life, I'm able to document that the white horse is a symbol for a man, the peacemaker. And in numerous of his appearances, he has selected this icon as the symbol that will represent him.
How are we to know when this person is on earth?
Well, the Hopi have an intuitive sense that he's on earth now. They call him Pahana, the true white brother. The Iroquois believe he's on earth now as well. The signal was the birth of the white buffalo calf several years ago, actually,
yes.
1994.
That's
further,
right.
We have Nostradamus, who says that he'll arrive in July of 1999.
So then, is he here or just on the way?
Well, what's the difference?
I don't know. A few years. Uh-huh. So you're right in the cosmic scheme of things. What...
Right. We're talking about an energetic movement. I didn't mean to be smart with my response there. But we're talking about a global setting. So much of what we get in the so-called talk of a second coming fails to take into account that there's got to be certain conditions that have to be in existence in order for this event to occur.
Mm-hmm.
One of them, quite synchronistically, was discussed by your guest last night, Greg Braden.
Yes.
The increase in the Earth's spiritual vibration. I was wondering if your listeners were aware that a prophecy concerning the raising of this spiritual vibration was literally nailed to the cross upon which Jesus was crucified upon.
All right, let me just say, I'm not sure Greg Braden was talking about a spiritual vibration. Now, it crosses into the world of spiritual things, but he was talking about the actual vibratory frequency of the earth itself, if I remember correctly.
Which translates into an uplift in the spiritual vibration.
All right, hold tight right there. We're already at the bottom of the hour, and it looks like what we're doing this evening will sort of wind from what we did last night. My guest is William Henry from Nashville, Tennessee. I'm Art Bell, and this, of course, is Coast to Coast AM. William Henry, William, one quick question for you, something I've struggled to understand. Michael Drosnin with the Bible Code. I've had other guests that have talked about coding in the Bible. And the one thing that has never quite made sense to me is why those who wrote it, the Word of God, or that God, if you will, if you consider the Bible to be, literal, why God would put anything in code, something that had to be deciphered to be understood?
My sense is because there's a stepping down process that goes on. Most of these texts are written in a language that I don't necessarily refer to as code, but rather as the language of the birds. It is called the language of the birds because the Latin ave means bird, and it also means angel. And this is why angels are shown with bird wings and so forth. And
mm-hmm.
This language of the birds that they speak in is meant to speak to hearts all across the world in different fashions and different manners, but always by attempting to deliver a consistent message. So, in a sense, it has to be that way so that people will begin to peer into it in order to extract the message that they are wanting to hear, what their hearts are looking to hear at that particular time in history.
Okay, so in other words, the idea is that God wanted us to look deeper, wanted us to study beyond the obvious.
In all traditions, there's an exoteric tradition, which is given to the masses, and an esoteric tradition, which is reserved for the initiates. Unfortunately, that esoteric tradition is very often hoarded by what can only be labeled as terrorists, seeking to deprive us of the knowledge that God wishes for us to have. The Dead Sea Scrolls are an excellent example of a state of affairs where there is knowledge in there, sacred knowledge that will enable us to take a quantum leap forward into a new golden age of learning. However, that knowledge is being suppressed by certain religious and political authorities.
Why?
Because, to put it bluntly, what these teachings are teachings designed to transform us into Christ-like beings. And you cannot have a planet full of Christ running around because they're simply unmanageable. In other words, if you have an average Joe person dealing with the teachings that will enable you to, for example, one of the teachings is for instant materialization of wishes. Imagine the kind of world that we would live in if all of us...
If you could just wish it to be true and it were so?
And it were so. Yet, that is the direction we are heading.
I do. I wonder what the world would be like if instead of factories and workers and all the rest of it, we could literally wish things into existence.
It would be a civilization based on love, whereas ours is presently based on fear. Although the Hopi are very clear that says that we are moving into a new world in which we will have a civilization based on love, in which we will be able to instantly materialize our wishes.
Yes, but how do you know that all people who would acquire these powers would be love-based? In other words...
Because you wouldn't be able to exist in this new world if you weren't love-based. If you have fear in your heart, you won't be in that world.
Suppose there's simply hatred or trickery or deceit in your heart, as there would be with some of the fallen angels. Then I might wish an atomic bomb into existence.
Yes, you might. And so that would be, that it could take us back to the reason why this is suppressed. And that's the reason I believe it is. I'm not much of a conspiracy theorist. It's very easy to jump to that as a conclusion. But I think in some cases, we're denied some of these teachings simply to protect us for that very reason you just spoke of.
Interesting. Now, how in the world did you get involved with UFOs?
You know what? There's a technical college here in Nashville, and some people were putting on one of Randy Winter's seminars.
Yes, I've interviewed Randy. Yes.
1989, my first exposure. And I was literally blown away by what I saw. It's still questionable whether or not those beam ships, those Pleiadian beam ships that people were so, degacked over are actually real or not. But it was a very impressive display, and I will never forget that drive home, the wonderment, which for the very first time I looked at the stars. It was a very, very definitely a mind-opening experience.
And how does that fit in with your theology? In other words, did it challenge it? Did it confirm it? Did it have nothing to do with it? How did you absorb that?
It picked me up off of one path and put me on another, led me into the works of Zechariah Sitchin's, devouring, all seven of his books two and three times, and being able to then expand the picture. I think the picture that I have of my theology is of a mosaic on the wall in front of me, and all of these teachings represent one little tile in the mosaic, and from time to time, so many of us put it in concrete, but I think it's something that's meant to be more of a tessellation that is rearranged from time to time. And that's what these teachings have helped me to do.
Where does Graham Hancock fit into the picture for you? What do you, you have studied Hancock.
You know what, one of the most influential months of my life was when I read Graham Hancock's book, The Sign and the Seal, and Holger Kirsten's book, Jesus Lived in India. You put those two guys together, and you have an incredibly powerful scenario that paints a picture of Jesus as a person that sought sacred teachings that were hidden, that one of those might even have included the acquisition of the Ark of the Covenant, and may also have included a trip by Jesus or other holy beings, including Moses, to another star system, probably Sirius, and the return to Earth with the divine teaching.
Graham Hancock is rather convinced that lying below the left paw of the Sphinx is a chamber which contains knowledge from a previous civilization. You aware of that?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I go into detail into it in my book because, according to Nostradamus, one of the missions of the peacemaker is to actually enter that Hall of Records,
yes,
reclaim the Ark of the Covenant, bring Moses back to life, and then reintroduce the Christ or Messiah. And it all takes place in that sacred hall.
Now, I have private indications, which I cannot discuss this evening, indicating that in all likelihood there will be an attempt to get to the tunnel or even directly into the chamber below the Sphinx, and that this attempt will be made next year in 1998.
And it will fail.
And it will fail?
Yes.
Why do you say that?
Because they're a year too early. The next most auspicious time astrologically for the opening of the Hall of Records does not happen until August 1999, when the Grand Cross, a conjunction of five constellations, occurs in the skies above the Earth. Mm-hmm. That's the sign of the Son of Man. It's the sign for the peacemaker to gather the races from the four directions and create a divinely inspired world peace. It's directly coincidental with his return in July 1999, and then, of course, the opening of the Hall of Records in August 1999.
Will the peacemaker, this peacemaker that you talk about, arrive as an adult, apparent human being, or will he be born as the Christ child was?
No, we're talking again about the herald. My sense is that it will be an adult human being who is performing a very specific mission. That's just my intuition, and there is the possibility that all this will simply begin in July 1999. However, Nostradamus does make a fairly clear observation that peace will begin to reign in the year 2002. Now, remember, in the book of Revelation, we have to have a 3.5-year battle between the opposing forces of light and darkness. So Nostradamus' July 1999 date going on into June 2002 is pretty close to that time frame.
What will this battle be like?
I have really struggled with that recently, having to dive into the book of Revelation and that whole concept of Armageddon. It's a deep chasm that you can really get lost in. And by my reckoning, and this is going to sound completely bizarre and wacky, and I hope I don't destroy my credibility, what the book of Revelation appears to be saying happens at Armageddon is a stargate opens. A being emerges and then leaves.
Where do you find this in Revelations, or what support do you find for that in Revelations?
It's in Revelation, I believe it's chapter 10, where there's something called a wine press is described. This wine press is approximately 12 miles square. It literally opens up out of nowhere. And what is described there is these various angels cutting down souls that don't belong in the wine press versus souls that do belong in the wine press. The reason the wine press matches up as a stargate is because it matches up with a story in Numbers 13 where Moses is taking the Israelites in the direction of the Promised Land, and he sends out a group of spies. These spies go to a place called the Valley of Eshkol. Eshkol means cluster, as in grapes. These spies come back to Moses and they're scared stiff. And the reason they're scared is because they realize that the giants live there, the sons of Anak. These are the Anunnaki of Sitchin's research. But that's not the real reason that these spies are so frightened. They tell Moses that the land there at the Valley of Eshkol eateth the people up. That's a very extraordinary description. If they wanted to say that a cave ate these people up or some sort of plague, all they had to do was say so. My sense is that they're describing an event or an occurrence that was beyond their comprehension. People were walking along the land, and all of a sudden they disappeared.
Mm.
And that is associated with this wine or vineyard-type place. And all of the metaphors that have to do with the up-leveling of the spiritual awareness, the transformation of the soul, and even Jesus' family have to do with the vine of a grape, or with grapes in general.
Would you presume this to occur in the Holy Land?
No.
No?
Not as we think of it. I have zeroed in on Rennes-le-Château, France, is where this event occurs.
Really?
Yes.
Well, of course, there's a lot of grape growing in France, a lot of vineyards, no
right.
question about that.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what led you there?
Yes, it is.
Why not California's wine country?
Well, because, again, it goes back to the connection with Nostradamus and also the mystic tradition of France in that area. There were several painters that actually painted that scene from Numbers 13 with the spies returning to Moses with a cluster of grapes at Rennes-le-Château. One of the missions of the peacemaker art is very fascinating. I puzzled over it for a while. He has to level the mountains of the Holy Land. Now, the picture that immediately came to my mind is that he's got to break down or crumble the mountains of the Holy Land, Jerusalem, to make way for the new Jerusalem. Because it's so enormous, it won't even fit on the existing Temple Mount. Therefore, the land around it has got to go. But then I went to Rennes-le-Château. And what I discovered there is this enormously vast and beautiful valley. There is a hilltop that is level. And on one hilltop is something called the Temple of Isis. Directly across the valley is the Temple of Osiris, another perfectly level hilltop.
Mm-hmm.
And at that instant, I understood what leveling the mountains of the Holy Land actually meant. It means leveling the mountaintops for probably to act as some sort of landing beacons or something. That's what is rampant throughout Sitchin's work, is an explanation for why the ancient gods would level the mountains of holy lands.
Landing areas for?
Perhaps some sort of interstellar craft, perhaps for some sort of device that will open up this enormous stargate.
You have a very interesting mix of a theology as I listen that kind of seems intertwined with the final days, with revelations, and with ufology. And you sort of mixed it all together, haven't you?
I think we have to. A careful reading of many ancient texts are loaded with references to sky beings, beings emerging from funny-looking or shiny craft that emerge from the heavens.
Mm-hmm. Let me take up the mantle of the born-again Christian who will come after you like a lion and rip you to shreds and say that...
be a Daniel.
What would come from these craft would be evil, would be tricksters, would be of the dark side.
To them it would be. A being of light, of any kind of significant spiritual teaching, would be perceived to that person in an inverted fashion. Light to them is dark to us.
Hmm. So what case would you make to them? I mean, what would you tell them? They are reading literal scripture, and they would be arguing with you, and so how would you...
Well, first of all, I begin with by looking at the book of Daniel and Revelation. Revelation is a book of 22 chapters divided into 11, two sections of 11. So you have an 11, it's almost like that doorway. Daniel is the primer for Revelation, which means you got to go back to understand Daniel or you're not going to get Revelation at all.
Mm-hmm.
When you go back to Daniel, you learn that the book of Daniel describes some events surrounding not an individual person named Daniel, but a group of people who were the Daniel. The Daniel were called the children of the goddess Dana, or the children of the goddess An. An and Dana all link up with the original Sumerian stories as a group of extraterrestrials that came to Earth, created an alien human hybrid race, and settled planet Earth. Therefore, what the book of Daniel is about, and therefore what Revelation is about, mm-hmm. is the comings and goings of this particular group of people, the children of the goddess Dana.
Why do you find it necessary to explain it in that manner as opposed to the traditional angel theory?
Well, because according to the Essenes, the children of the goddess Dana were the fallen angels. They're one and the same.
One and the same.
Mm-hmm.
From God or from an alien race?
No, more than likely from an alien race, perhaps under instruction from a higher being. Certainly not God with a capital G as the creator of the universe, but God in terms of a being capable of manipulating the human race.
Okay, I'm struggling to understand exactly where you're coming from. Do you believe in the God of the Bible?
Do I believe that Yahweh is the creator of the universe?
Sure.
No.
You do not.
No, I do not.
You believe the universe then was created by others?
A far more magnificent being than the jealous and hateful God that is described in the Old Testament and carried through into the New Testament. I mean, the God that's presented in the Old Testament is a totally fallible being. It seems to me that the all-beneficent creator of the universe would be more of a being of perfection and purity.
A lot of what is called hatred or fear of God, though, is read into all of that by man. I, too, have always felt that this fear of God is silliness. There should not be a fear of God. If God is the being that we imagine him to be, there would be no need for fear. So I agree with that, but I'm not sure that I agree with your leap to believe that. It sounds like you've got a disturbed cat in the background.
I do. I am so sorry. That is my sister's cat, Opie. He's normally very polite, but tonight he decided he had something to say.
Yeah, well, get on the telephone, and maybe your cat's upset with what you're saying.
And Art,
yes.
Thank you very much for allowing me to express that opinion, and honestly...
Oh, no, look, we're here to lay it out the way it is. I'm not going to tread softly around anything. We'll just explore it as it is. Stand by, we're at the top of the hour, okay? A couple of more questions so that I can try and understand exactly where William Henry is coming from, and then we're going to go to the phones. William, if I understand what you have just said properly prior to the top of the hour, let me ask you this. That man who walked on earth that we have called Christ, the Son of God or Messiah, who, in your opinion, was that man?
Who?
Yes, who was that man? If not, then the Son of God. Who was that man?
Well, he could still be the Son of God. Was he God incarnate at that time? Probably. I also lean towards the feeling that this was a man who functioned as a man, who lived as a man, and also had this extraordinary function of introducing a higher vibrational energy called love into our world, which was to be shared by each of us and to become the dominant force in each of our lives. Which what I'm trying to say is that each of us, the mission of each of our lives is to become a Christ-like being. And I also further believe that all of Western civilization, all Western history, hinges on one letter, and that's the letter I. When Jesus said, I am the way and the truth and the light, follow me, in effect, was he saying that he was the only Son of God, the only way and the truth and the light, or was he saying, become like him? I believe that if you believe he was the only Savior, you're living in a world of fear because you fear the day that figure will return. If, on the other hand, you take his message to say, become like me, I am a model, follow me in this manner, you live in a world of love.
You said before the break that you did not believe in God as the God of the Bible, the all-encompassing creator.
Correct. The gods, they're plural in the Old Testament, are sometimes bumbling fools. Sometimes they are extraordinarily kind beings. That duality is what distinguishes them, I believe, from the creator of the universe.
All right, then, I guess that's why I followed up with the question about who Christ was. Mm-hmm. If you don't believe that there is this all-encompassing creator, mm-hmm. I mean, to read the Bible, Christ was the son of this all-encompassing creator, and so I see a little bit of a problem there. You're saying, yeah, you said, yes, I think Christ was the son of God.
Mm-hmm.
Of what God?
Well, he would have been the son, likely, of Yahweh, since that would be the line that he followed. He was a priest after the order of Melchizedek, which was the line of Yahweh. Yahweh, unfortunately, according to most scholarly research, was not the creator of the universe. It is a lesser God-man.
So then we are all, in effect, worshiping, if we are worshiping the God of the Bible, the wrong entity, that in other words, maybe I'm getting mixed up here.
No, you have it correct. That's exactly right.
That is exactly right.
That is what I intend to say.
Okay. If you intend to say it, then say it. You have a first-time caller line. You're on the air with William Henry. Hello.
Hi, I'm calling from Oregon.
Yes, sir.
Got a quick comment for my question, if I can.
Sure.
I missed about the first half hour of the show. Did your guest say that he believed that it said something about Elijah and that this being could be Elijah or Moses?
Yes, I did say that. What's your name?
And my name is John.
Hi, John.
Hi. Well, I just have a question because what I did hear you say was that you believe that John the Baptist was Elijah's come back, supposedly.
Mm-hmm.
And that is true because that's what Jesus says in Matthew 11, 10 through 15. He explicitly states that John was Elijah who was for to come.
Yes.
And that's the Old Testament version. The only other being that he states, that Jesus states anywhere, that comes before his coming, the peacemaker, is the Antichrist, which is mm-hmm. clearly taught in Revelation and Daniel.
Mm-hmm.
And also, by the way, I heard you say when Jesus said I, Jesus didn't say I. You're taking only half of what Jesus said. The word he used translates I am. And that's why they would get so upset when he's in the synagogue, because when he said I am, that's what Yahweh used to say, I am, which means the one and only all-encompassing God of the Bible. But my real question is this. I hear you quoting a lot from the Bible, you know, Daniel and Revelation, you're using references. If you don't believe that the God is the God of the Bible, or that gods, plural, which when he says gods, it just says, you know, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Well, that's why the Old Testament uses the plural, because Jesus was with God at that time, too, just as the New Testament says. That's why it's a plural in there, so you're correct in the plural. But anyway, if the God of the Bible doesn't exist, why do you use any references out of the Bible that is the same writings that says that the God that it talks about is the only God?
Yeah, put very well. I would have asked exactly the same question.
And if these parts about Daniel and Revelation as well, because the whole Bible talks about the coming of Christ, not just Daniel and Revelation, but they do concentrate on it. If those parts there that you keep picking out, you know, to make your points are true, why isn't the part about God being the only God also true? Why is that?
Oh, well, the reason is because those parts of the Bible, you mentioned the book of Genesis just a moment ago when you described in the beginning was the Word.
Well, that's
wait a minute. Let him finish.
Okay, I was just going to say that's not Genesis.
Okay, but let him go ahead and finish.
That text, those that he cited, came from earlier texts that were already in existence. And that's the reason that I feel comfortable in being able to pull from selectively from the Bible, as is it a simply another text from a different culture?
Okay, well, what part of the Old, because what you quoted was from the New Testament, not the Old Testament, that first part, in the beginning when the Word was with God and the Word was God, that's New Testament writings, it's not Old Testament. Because most of the Old Testament taught that, that just used it in the plural sense of the words, which it was. Every time it's translated as God, it is translated plural.
Correct.
But, in the pillar of fire that went before him, and Jesus was always spoken of as a strong angel when he was in his earthly form, such as in the pillar of fire. But that's my main point, is I just can't see how you could use some parts of the Bible, believing some of it, not believing other of it, when inextricably throughout not only the Old Testament portions, but they coincide with the New Testament portion. We're talking about documents written over 2,000-year span over many different cultures.
Mm-hmm.
And they all say the same thing. And so I'm just confused on that. By the way, Art, just as a comment,
yes.
Before I go, this is the person Patsy talked about when she talked about the ones who will go in ignorance.
Okay. Guess.
I mean, I don't mean that derogatory, because I mean it. I think it's sad. I really do. I think it's sad because I listen to all the things this guy is saying, and it's exactly what Jesus talks about, when Paul said the spirit of Antichrist is already in the world. This is the spirit of Antichrist.
I was about to, at the beginning of this hour, suggest to you the same thing. What you call the peacemaker to come, that to precede the return of Christ, how do you know that you are not talking about the Antichrist?
Excellent question. Their missions are different. Broadly speaking, and this comes from the Talmud, the mission of the peacemaker is to recover the key of life, which is the staff of miracles Moses used to part the Red Sea, to recover the Ark of the Covenant, to bring Moses back to life, and to level the mountains of the Holy Land and introduce the Christ or Messiah. That's his mission. The mission, on the other hand, of the Antichrist is to create a seven-year peace treaty, to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem, to create a unified global economy, and to serve everyone with the mark of the beast. That's how you tell the two apart.
But that since neither that we know of has yet come, how do you know that which you regard as the peacemaker is indeed going to have the mission you are describing and not the mission that you should fear?
Just simply by looking at the various traditions, what this figure has done historically in his various incarnations. This peacemaker didn't appear just as a Hebrew man named John. He appeared as an Iroquois Indian named Daganoweda.
But isn't the Antichrist, and I'm not a biblical scholar, so I'm just sort of toying about the edges here, but is he not to be one of deceit? Will he not appear to be a peacemaker?
Oh, yeah. We'll be asked to worship him as God and believe in this figure as God. That's very clearly stated. The peacemaker is more of a behind-the-scenes type figure whom you may never even truly appreciate as a global figure.
All right, East of the Rockies, you're on the air with William Henry. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I basically want to ask him again to clarify his scenario of how Christ will appear in the second coming, as that's the event that most Christians are looking forward to. I come from a denomination that teaches that when Christ comes, he's going to come in the clouds visibly where every eye will see him. And the first, the dead in Christ will rise, and then the righteous dead that are in the graves will rise first, and then we who are righteous that are alive will be caught up in the air and meet the Lord in the air. How does he see that? I mean, I got that from several. I can give him some.
Do the wild thing. It's 702-727-1295. I had to bleep that out, Dale. We don't allow last names to be used on the air, so...
I'm sorry.
Let's just correct it and say you are Dale.
Yes.
Okay?
Dale, I appreciate the question, but it's just not simply something that I'm addressing at this time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to establish the existence of a herald or a forerunner and what that figure will do. And far be it from me to speak for exactly how Christ or anybody else is going to come.
Well, so you're not talking about Christ who's coming. You're talking about someone else who's going to come?
Correct.
And this person is not the Antichrist?
Correct.
That's what he says.
Hmm.
And I've been asking him, how he can be absolutely certain that the one he calls the peacemaker is not the Antichrist, because the Antichrist is going to be very good, is my understanding, at deception, and will be seen as a peacemaker.
Yeah. Can I throw a huge kink in this, Art?
Any time you want.
Nostradamus called the returning peacemaker the King of Terror, and said he would resurrect a figure called the King of Angoumois. And numerous Nostradamus interpreters have put forth the proposition that this King of Terror is an alien invasion force that will come out of the sky, wipe out New York, cause instantaneous cataclysmic earth changes, and then will destroy Jerusalem. The King of Angoumois, they have presented, is the returning King of the Mongols, a returning Genghis Khan who will slaughter millions of people.
Hello, Art.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to bring up a few biblical texts. If people want to look up 2 Corinthians 11:14, it says there that Satan will be transformed into an angel of light. Revelation 16:14 says that the evil angels, along with Satan, will work miracles to try and deceive the very elect. 2 Thessalonians 2:9, and as well as...
All right, I really don't want to turn this into a battle of Scripture.
Right.
I really don't.
Yeah.
But I appreciate your call. Thank you. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with William Henry. Hello.
Hello, and thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
The first gentleman who called took quite a few of my questions about how could you be so certain that you are not talking about the Antichrist, etc.
Yes.
Well, for me, I would like to get back to the basics, because there is something that disturbs me very much, and that is you are so focused on Yahweh. Why did you pick Yahweh? I mean, Lord God Almighty is so mighty and so wonderful. What about Father God Jehovah? What happened to him? I mean, are you allowing yourself to just be distracted by one semantic distortion, or what?
No, the reason that I use that, ma'am, is because Yahweh appears very often in other guises in different cultures that involve the peacemaker. And that's the reason that I focused on him. I'll give you an example. In the Sumerian text, his original name was Enki. And he appeared there as a very helpful being that delivered enormously popular and powerful teachings to the people of his time. Osiris is another name for this being, as he appeared in the Egyptian tradition. So when I use Yahweh, I'm using a name that most people identify with, as opposed to Jehovah, but also because he appears in these various traditions.
I can see where your point is. You are very bright, Bible. You have really, in my opinion, allowed yourself to be badly deceived by focusing on that one all-identifiable name.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you very much for your opinion. I hope you'll read my book, and perhaps then you'll be able to have perhaps a more expanded view of what I'm trying to present here.
Okay, thank you very much. William, I guess I would have to read your book, too, because I really kind of have the same take. I'm not an overly religious person,
mm-hmm,
by any means, but it seems to me that your theology and dismissing the greater bulk, and I'm not comfortable with that.
Hmm. Well, I certainly appreciate that. Again, The cherry picking is to be perfectly honest with you, in the book, fairly selective. I think we've magnified it to a great deal this evening.
Mm-hmm.
Because I focus on the Mayan tradition, the Egyptian tradition, the tradition of the South Americans, of the American Indian tradition. And each of these cultures and civilizations have something to say on this matter.
Did you hear Patsy, Harlot?
No, sir, I didn't.
You didn't. She was actually, she called herself a witch, but I would call her more of a devil worshiper.
Mm-hmm.
And she would, I think, find what you've had to say here very helpful to her cause and her belief. Now, that's just my opinion. And have you examined and worried yourself about what you've done in terms of creating your belief system based on sort of a part of the Bible and a part of this and a part of that, and throwing it all together in a conclusion that this being who is coming that will precede Christ will be a positive entity, and you can be so sure that it's not the Antichrist?
Oh, absolutely.
Uh-huh. All right, stand by. We're at the bottom of the hour. We'll be right back. William Henry is my guest. In State Line, Nevada, says, you know, Art, I'll bet JC's dialing finger is raw by now. Good morning. It seems your guest is suggesting that there is one God, creator of everything, and then a sub-God assigned to each universe. Can it also be assumed that these lesser gods, all in quotes, were once mortal beings elevated through good deeds to the position they now occupy? Does that fit in, William?
That works for me.
It does.
Yes, it does. How does it sound to you, Art?
How does it sound to me? It sounds as though anything could be possible, and you know what? I have absolutely no problem with your having a theology that differs from straight biblical text.
I was thinking about that during the break too. It's nice that we can disagree, yet we can still continue to have a conversation.
Well, that's what it's all about. I think that what bothers me about our conversation this morning is that you're mixing the two.
Playing a little too fast and loose with the facts.
Possibly.
Yeah.
First-time caller line, you're on the air with William Henry. Hello.
Well, thank you, Art. You startled me when you called me a minute ago because I was not expecting to be called. I'm a long-time listener and a first-time caller, and I'm enjoying Mr. Henry quite a lot tonight. I'm enjoying him for a very special reason. First of all, if there's anything we should have learned as people in the last few years, is that the Hubble telescope has shown us that any idea that we may have about the creator of the universe is wrong. Purely and simply has to be wrong.
What is it the Hubble has shown us that
does? Oh, my God, it's shown us solar systems and galaxies and stars bubbling out of etheric space.
Oh, yes, it has absolutely has shown us the process of ongoing creation. That's what you mean to say, right?
Oh, absolutely. You said
yes, but the Hubble telescope. Yeah, but the Hubble telescope has not shown us a hand involved in this creation.
Well, I don't think that it really has to, because here's the reason it doesn't. Because a hand is probably not involved in it. One of the points that I wanted to make, and I want to make this point if I make nothing else, we are still very elemental beings. We're three-dimensional beings. Now, your friend Danny and Brinkley, whom I admire, you know, here's a man who has moved away from three-dimensional. So you can talk to Danny about something about a God that you couldn't talk to the average person on the street. Now, my next point is that you can't take the Bible and say this is a fact. If you read just the first part of the first book of Genesis, you find 3 days and three nights before there was a star in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went to school, they said, by George, the reason we have morning and nights is because the Earth is rotating around on its axis and the sun, you know, quote-unquote, the sun comes up.
Yes.
So you have to dismiss the Bible as being a literal book. It simply isn't. Another example that I really love is this tirade that this Old Testament God went through after the serpent tempted Eve, and he told the serpent, you know, I'm going to put enmity between your seed and the woman's seed. Now, as I understand seed in the Bible, it's, you know, procreation. I didn't know snakes were procreating with women. So there's obviously another message throughout the entire Bible, and this young man has as much a right as anybody
absolutely.
To interpret it.
Absolutely. I agree with you, and thank you very much for the call. Of course, everybody is entitled to put together their own belief system, and yours, William, is a particularly interesting one.
May I make a comment about the Hubble Space Telescope?
Yeah, you may, because it's in here. I was just about to ask about that. Sure.
I like to look at it in light of the Tower of Babel episode. The Tower of Babel was the tower that reached into heavens, which was built in Babylon, which means gate. And in the biblical story, that we get this illustration of Babylon as being a place of lust and prostitution and all things carnal.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the language of the birds, this code language we spoke of earlier, it's interesting to take a look at the word Hubble. When you break the word Hubble down, the first two letters are H-U, which in numerous traditions means shining or effervescent one or even God.
Yes.
And the B-B-L-E could certainly refer to Babel or gate. Could the Hubble Space Telescope be our gate to God, that for whatever reason God has enabled us to peer into the garden? One of the humorous things that I notice is that as these ancient archetypes are reenacted, and I believe they're being reenacted in our modern culture, there's so much humor in it, because Edwin Hubble, when he looked through his telescope, he was looking through the 100-inch Hooker Space Telescope.
Wild Card Line, you're on the air with William Henry. Hello.
Hey, how's it going, Art?
Okay.
Hey, how's it going, William?
Hi.
My name is Tony. I'm calling from Las Vegas, KXNT.
Right.
Hey, Tony.
I wanted to make a comment and get William's take on it. I feel like I agree with him on a lot of things, except for maybe the peacemaker, as he talks about it. But my belief is that God is an extraterrestrial so advanced, but he didn't create the universe, but does and will terraform life, such as our world. However, I believe he has also created the majority of the extraterrestrial life that we know or suspect that is there. A lot of people claim is there, I know is there, and that there are other creatures like him that design, blueprint, copyright, their own possibly universes, and talk to our God on a virtually contractual basis. But I don't believe in Satan or hell. Only self-created ones. What's your take on that, William? And I'll just listen in or off the air. Is that okay?
All right, Tony, thank you. So he's saying no hell. Heaven,
yeah.
Perhaps, and
great
God.
Great question, Tony.
But no hell.
The Sumerians were very explicit about it. Remember, at one time people believed that our world was flat?
Sure.
That notion came from the Sumerian idea that we lived in a four-cornered world. And this, immediately we're led to believe that we're talking about the Earth. In actuality, what the Sumerians were discussing was a sector of space demarcated by four constellations, the lion, bull, man, and eagle. Exactly the same four beasts which create the Sphinx, which is a composite beast of the lion, bull, man, and eagle. The reason there's only four books in the New Testament is so that it would line up with this idea here. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are also represented by the lion, bull, man, and eagle. And what the Sumerians describe is that our four-cornered world is sort of an aquarium within the cosmic ocean. This aquarium is designed to keep the harmful spirits of Corazon, which was the true heavenly name for Satan, from entering this realm. Corazon and Satan are two completely different beings. These negative entities have no relation whatsoever to this being that is referred to as Satan and who is originally called Samuel and is referred to by other names. So I think it's very interesting that people are beginning to develop an awareness that we could be the product of somebody's science project. This four-cornered world reappears in the book of Revelation, and it happens that Jesus is the one who commands this science project.
So maybe we are the product of some ninth grader's science project on Vega.
Quite conceivably. But actually, probably not Vega. The ancients were very explicit that these beings came from the central sun,
our
galactic core, which is called Tula.
Picked a place, that's all. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with William Henry. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Where are you?
Nashville, Tennessee.
All right. Nashville to Nashville.
A hometown boy.
I'm calling to support him in some way. I don't necessarily believe in all of this in sort of faith sense, but I do read ancient books, the New Testament, the Old Testament, the Nag Hammadi, the Dead Sea Scrolls. I just want to support him on some of the things he's saying about the text, at least. I'm not sure if any of this is going to unfold.
I didn't realize I was stepping into a crucifixion tonight.
I think you are. I think there's a lot of people that aren't supporting you. But no, some of the things like he just said about the four beasts and the four writers of the Gospels, and I mean, this is not a secret to people who are involved in this scholarly study of some of these books. These symbols come up again and again and again. A lot of this even Graham Hancock has in his book. Melchizedek thing that he mentioned earlier, that's real. I mean, that's not out of nowhere. That's in the New Testament, if you believe in that. It's in Hebrews. What I was wondering is how much of this comes from Gnostic scriptures. The reason I ask is because the line of Melchizedek thing that's in the New Testament, the Melchizedek figure is first sort of blown up into this big non-dying being in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and the notion of Yahweh being an evil god. And by the way, he's right. Yahweh was not originally a creator god; he was a weather god. I heard the idea being batted around that the Old Testament God is an evil god. Well, that's the number one premise of Gnostic scriptures in the Nag Hammadi library and others, the Neoplatonists. I was wondering how much of this does he think is coming from particularly the Nag Hammadi and the Dead Sea Scrolls?
Well, of course, it's all Gnostic. Gnostic is a Greek word that means knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And the Gnostics were typically people that followed the esoteric tradition.
Mm-hmm.
They dove beyond the surface of the Sunday school stories that were presented and sought to transform themselves into beings of light. In the Gnostic text, the Pistis Sophia, Jesus tells us, seek ye the mysteries that will enable you to cleanse and purify your soul and transform yourself into a being of light. That apparently is the purpose of our existence on earth, is to come here to learn to heal ourselves, to learn to heal our world, and then to ascend to a higher plane. There isn't a single church, to my knowledge, in America, Christian church, that is teaching these sacred texts,
mm-hmm.
these teachings that will enable you to ascend through your light body. There is an enormous underground movement. Drumvalo Melchizedek offers classes on this. Greg Braden dances around this in his seminars. There are numerous people around the world that are regathering these texts at this moment and disseminating to those who wish to transform themselves in this manner.
And you think that's directly linked to the coming of this peacemaker, or?
I believe it is. Now, the guests that we heard in the previous hour would say that we're being deceived, that this is a satanic movement to take power that does not belong to us and to usurp the power of God.
Yeah, that's another thing I was calling in about. If anybody reads the text, I think he has a good point for a herald. like I say, I don't necessarily take this on faith or anything, but reading the scripture, reading these ancient texts, there is something. And it's like reading, if you will, a program to a play where it describes the characters and what they're going to do in the play. And there's no confusion. There is a figure 666 who's going to come and do his thing, and it delineates what he's going to do. And there is room for a coded herald, I believe, in Revelations and some of these other books. And there's no confusion in the text. Now, if you're talking about someone who may see the coming of one of these and confuse it for the other one or something, that's a different question to me. But I think as far as what he's reading from the text themselves, I don't know about the interpretation, but I support the reading.
All right. Excellent. Thank you very much for the call. West of the Rockies, good morning. You're on the air with William Henry.
Good morning, Art. This is Al from Joshua Tree.
Hi, Al.
And I'd like to ask a couple of questions of Mr. Henry, and then I'll hang up and listen off the air.
Sure.
I'd like to ask you, Mr. Henry, if you believe that Enki will return, and number two, how much do you know of Apollonius of Tyana, and do you believe it was possible that Apollonius of Tyana was the real teacher of the New Testament? I thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
All right.
Enki, for everyone's information, was part of the Sumerian pantheon, believed to have been an extraterrestrial bioengineer who came to Earth from a planet, 12th planet in our solar system called Nibiru, and genetically altered humanity and put us on our present spiritual path.
Sitchin's work.
Yes, he's the serpent of the Old Testament. He is Satan, for all practical intents and purposes.
Okay.
Do I believe Enki will be returning? I think Enki is all around us. Enki created or implanted a specific group of souls on Earth, and those souls apparently are still reincarnating on Earth. We could talk another hour about Enki if you like, because he's an enormously fascinating figure whose relevance is becoming more and more appropriate in these types of conversations, because he apparently was there at the beginning and will be there at the end.
And Apollonius.
Apollonius, I'm deeply sorry to say I'm not familiar with that figure.
All right. East of the Rockies, good morning. You're on the air with William Henry.
Good morning, Art. This is Megan in Dallas.
How are you doing?
Fine. I was wondering if Mr. Henry had heard anything about the Bible code and what his thoughts were on that.
Yeah, you know what? The only experience I had with that, I was out on a blanket with my girlfriend. She was reading it, and it brought tears to her eyes. And she looked me dead in the eye and says, "We got to stop this." And because it's so horrifying, the picture that is presented there. Again, I went and looked at the book of Revelation and that story of Armageddon. It appears that that event actually was ancient history. It is the story of the creation of the earth and the arrival of this being we call Enki. And if we have a moment, I would like to be able to describe that story, because it's the bedrock of Sitchin's research, and it is actually the preface to all of the creation myths that appear in many of the sacred texts around the world.
All right. Go right ahead.
Okay. According to the Sumerian story and Sitchin's reinterpretation of these myths, before our solar system was created, there was a planet called Nibiru, which originated from a constellation called Ophiuchus, which is nearest the galactic core. Nibiru is apparently a marauding planet. It goes around, and at one such time it was suffering from an atmospheric crisis, and it went out in search of materials, Sitchin believes it was gold, to repair the decaying atmosphere of that world. While on one of these gold-seeking missions, it ran into an altercation with another planet in our solar system called Tiamat. Tiamat means mother of all things, the watery dragon of chaos. In the Sumerian stories, they describe the splitting in half of Tiamat, because of the of its interaction with Nibiru. One half of Tiamat became the asteroid belt. The other half of Tiamat became Earth. Earth, according to Sitchin, is Tiamat reincarnated. When you see the dragon referred to in the Book of Revelation, as in Jesus coming out of the sky and kicking a dragon's ass, you're talking about Tiamat. Therefore, you are also talking about Earth. And what Sitchin says happened is that this figure Enki was called to Earth to mine gold from the waters of Earth to then transport back to Nibiru. In the process of mining this gold, he discovered that his harmonic process for bringing it out of the water was insufficient, and that the way to do it was to mine it out of the ground in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Along the way, the astronauts who were assigned to this task mutinied, and this precipitated a court-martial, and it was during this court-martial that Enki proposed the idea of creating a slave race from the Homo erectus creature that he saw running around the African safari. Now, what happens is that Enki discovered that he needed souls to inhabit these bodies, otherwise they were a lifeless heap of chemicals. And numerous authors, including William Bramley and even Sitchin, have looked at this and asked the question, where did Enki get the souls to deposit into these bodies?
Indeed.
Did he just happen to have a pure soul laying around his lab or what? Bramley proposes that he got them from the same place we would get them today.
Which would be?
Criminals, deviants, prisoners of war, and other undesirables.
Huh, just the way America began.
The way America began. However, from reading the stories on Enki, that did not strike me as quite true.
All right. We are at another break point, so let's do one more. Now back to William Henry. William Henry is my guest. He has written a book called The Peacemaker and the Key of Life. The peacemaker is one who will come ahead of the Christ. It's rather interesting theology. The Christ returning, but not necessarily the Christ of the God that we understand to be the all-encompassing creator of all there is. William Henry does not believe in that, but believes perhaps that there are sub-gods. We discussed that a little while ago, and I've got several questions, interesting ones. A lot of people want to talk to you, William, but let me ask several questions first. Art, ask William if he is certain that Peacemaker is a man. Couldn't it be a woman?
Oh, beautiful question. Wherever possible, and in numerous instances when I document the past lives or past appearances of the Peacemaker, his wife always accompanies him.
Oh.
In the Egyptian tradition, it was Thoth. He was credited as the supervisor of the construction of the pyramid in the Hall of Records. And his beloved Sechet was with him at all times. And by conjecture is assumed to return with him. In fact, she is often credited with checking his work. So she's typically the one. And this relationship appeared again in the story of Jesus and Mary Magdalene,
mm-hmm.
where these two had an amazing relationship, to say the least. And it was always the interplay between the two. Now, remember, she's the one that anointed Jesus.
Yes.
Played a very important role, was believed to have been given his most secretive oral teachings concerning his deepest secrets concerning the universe, which she was thought to have taken to Rennes-le-Château. France. So in our present context, I'm anticipating that he and she will be operating together. She'll go on and survive. Excuse me. The men write things down in their history. That's why the women are often omitted. The women seem to have more of an oral tradition, passing it along from mother to daughter to mother to daughter.
All right, and this one. Art, what do you and your guest think of the theory that Satan and his angels could come to power under the guise of an alien encounter? This would make it easy for the Antichrist to gain credibility as a peacemaker if he was the only one who the aliens communicated with. We are getting more and more prepared for such an encounter. That's Brett in Albany, Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Typically, the peacemakers are not extraterrestrials. They are men of the Earth who are perhaps trained by extraterrestrials. Does that answer the question?
It does. And then finally, this. Hi, Art. I've been listening to the program. I believe what your guest is saying about the God of the Bible is that the God of the Bible is a group of beings called the Nephilim. Anyone who has read Zachariah Sitchin's 12th Planet would be familiar with the Nephilim. My question is, would you please ask your guest if he can elaborate on the God who created the universe? Nephilim, I believe, are the mixes between angels that have taken Earth women. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah, they're the giants, the people of the rocket ships. Unfortunately, there is very little in these texts about the creator of the universe. In fact, the question that I asked or posed to Zachariah Sitchin and never really did get a satisfactory answer was, to whom does he pray to?
Mm-hmm.
Knowing what he knows about the Sumerian texts, and my sense is that in Zechariah Sitchin's library, he's got stuff he hasn't even shown us yet that will just utterly blow our minds. So the point is, we ain't seen nothing yet.
William, who do you pray to?
To be perfectly honest?
Mm-hmm.
The mother.
The mother?
Mm-hmm. I pray to the mother. I pray to, and I envision that as perhaps a feminine type energy, but I pray to the mother.
So you think then the God force, the immediate God force, or the one that you believe in, is a feminine force?
Yes, I do, because even Enki was subservient, and subservient is a contemporary 20th century male term. Enki yielded to his life mate, Ninharzag, a female entity. He looked to her for guidance. And this is Tiamat. This goes back to that planet the reincarnated planet, was a feminine-oriented planet. And there's numerous traditions that uphold the goddess as the creator of the universe.
Mm-hmm. All right, back to the phones we go. First time caller line, you're on the air with William Henry. Good morning. Hello there.
Hello, Art.
Yes, hi. Where are you?
I'm calling from Abilene, Kansas.
Abilene, Kansas. All
been
right.
There, nice little town.
Yeah. Okay. I've heard William Henry speaking about quite a few interesting things. He sounds knowledgeable in quite a few areas in that, and I hear him speaking a lot about Yahweh. And I was wondering, does he believe that Yahweh created the earth, or Yahweh was a man, and does he base that on the Bible? And I have just a few more questions and another statement, I guess.
Well, I'm glad we got back to that, because no, Yahweh did not create the earth. Yahweh arrived after the creation of the earth, during the cataclysm of Tiamat.
Okay, and when you speak of Tiamat, are you referring to the Babylonian story, the Enuma Elish?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's interesting there, because, well, if you're basing the story about the creation of Yahweh, or not creating the earth from the Bible, or Yahweh being a man, do you believe that Yahweh was a man figure?
Yes.
Okay, because, well, I'm not a Bible scholar or anything, but I have studied Bible somewhat and various sources and that, and I know in Genesis there's two accounts of creation, and one mentions Yahweh, and that's Genesis 1, and everything there evolves in a cosmic sense.
Right.
Where
then you have
Yahweh
the creation
spoke
of man.
The world into existence. He spoke man into existence. And then in Genesis 2, we see God being referred to as Elohim.
God spoke man into existence because that's the only way that he could communicate to souls. And all traditions before that the human soul was feminine in nature.
Right, but what I'm saying is we see the Bible, when it refers to God in a manly form, refers to him as Elohim. They show him in the ground forming man out of the dust.
Right.
They speak of Elohim. But whenever they refer to Yahweh, they refer to him in a cosmic sense. And this is, some people believe, a lot of scholars believe this is because there was two sources. Well, there's more than two sources, but in this case, two sources that contributed to the Bible. And one of them was from the northern kingdom and one was from the southern. And these stories about creation come from the same time period that the Enuma Elish was created. And a lot of these weren't written down at the time of creation.
They were written down during the Babylonian captivity when the Jews were taken to Babylon. They were surprised to learn that the Sumerians had their prehistory already worked out. And in fact, they were able to fill in the details of the stories that they didn't have. However, that set of circumstances arose. So therefore, I don't dismiss the Old Testament stories, but following the lead of Zechariah Sitchin, why work with plagiarized copies when you can deal with the originals?
Do you believe that creation occurred instantaneously, where there was nothing, suddenly there was something, and what we understand or what scientists believe to be the Big Bang, and that everything is, in effect, flying away further and further and further?
The closest I can even come to even imagining the set of circumstances that led to creation, I put into a children's story called Junior Cosmic Egg, which was the story of a cosmic egg named Junior who grows up to become his own universe. And he does so by thinking it into existence.
So there was
an original thought.
An original thought. Whose original thought?
I wish I know. But again, you look out through the Hubble Space Telescope at all these billions of galaxies out there. Where did they come from?
I don't know, but it's obvious there's somebody out there still thinking.
Yeah, and we must be connected with all these other galaxies.
All right, Wildcard Line, you're on the air with William Henry. Hello.
Hello.
Hello there.
I'm Cecilia from Vermilion, South Dakota.
Well, hi there.
I would like to ask him about Rene Chateau.
Oh, okay.
Did you read about that from the Holy Blood, Holy Grail, or is there other books?
Yes, ma'am. I read Holy Blood, Holy Grail. There are other books. One very good book is called The Secrets of Rene Le Chateau.
Okay.
By Lionel and Patricia Fanthorpe. You can order it from most bookstores. I've been to Rene Le Chateau. It's a magical little village in the mountains of the Pyrenees.
Yes.
And the legend is that after the crucifixion, Mary Magdalene sailed to France, pregnant with Jesus' children, and raised them there at Rene Le Chateau.
Yeah. Do you ever think that maybe it wasn't Jesus' children, it could have been Thomas's?
Yeah, or John the Baptist, possibly.
I think more Thomas, since Thomas was supposed to have been the twin of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
I have another question, but it just left me.
It flew away, huh?
It flew away.
All right. Well, listen, thank you very much for the call.
Okay. Thanks.
And you take care. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with William Henry. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, I'm calling from Dallas.
All right.
I have read a new book called The Tomb of God.
Mm-hmm.
I really am into this, the story of Mary Magdalene and Joseph of Arimathea.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to know your comments on that. And also, I would like to point out to everybody that the Bible is history, and the word history is a compound word meaning his story. So, you know, we can take and we can learn from that, but at the same time, it's stories.
Thank you. The Tomb of God is another book on Rene Le Chateau. It purports to locate the actual tomb of Jesus at Rennes, the idea being that he would have lived out his lifetime after the crucifixion in or near that area, and was up to some pretty sneaky activity there, apparently. And it was a sensational bestseller in England. And we really don't have this type of discussion about Rennes Le Chateau and the survival of Jesus after the crucifixion in this country as they do in Europe. They're deeply rooted in the Gnostic tradition there and are actively pursuing many of these secrets right now. And in fact, I have a book coming out probably next year called Blue Apples, which represents a potential solution to the mystery of Rennes Le Chateau.
When the Hall of Records is opened, mm-hmm. when this chamber under the Sphinx that they have definitely confirmed now is there, at least with radar, is open, and the Hall of Records is recovered, mm-hmm. what specifically do you expect them to find?
I expect them to find a 45-foot-high device called the Great Ascender. Osiris's ladder into heaven, mm-hmm. Jacob's ladder, the Tree of Life. These are various names for the same device. It has an Ark of the Covenant, a transdimensional device as a base, and it has this enormous golden pillar on top of it. In the stories recorded by Zechariah Sitchin, and even recorded in the Book of Daniel, this device is used apparently to open up gateways to other dimensions. And I believe that among other artifacts, that this will be the primary artifact that is discovered within the Hall of Records.
In other words, a transportation device.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. A device that's used to tie the thread.
There really is some reason to believe that you could be right on the money, because one thing I discovered in Egypt, and I think just about everybody knows now, is that the pyramids and the Sphinx were not places of burial.
Right.
There's no question about it. They were not, and that is a popular myth, mm-hmm. that they were burial places for the pharaohs. Ain't so. They've never found one there. So whatever the pyramids and the Sphinx and what lies below it might be, one thing it is not is a burial ground. So then you are forced to search for what other purpose they might be there. And, of course, they are not the only pyramids. We're beginning now to look at pyramids all over the world, Asia, South America, even this country. All over the world there are pyramids. So somebody once knew something that we have not yet rediscovered.
I agree. It's utterly fascinating to me that the Great Pyramid sits on a much more magnificent structure, that 12-acre megalithic platform the Egyptians called the Egg of Creation.
Mm-hmm.
That is an astonishing piece of technology that's still level to within 1 degree yet today.
That is true.
So in that context, the Giza Plateau is a womb. What happens inside of a womb? A transformation takes place.
Mm-hmm.
One way of living, one being, is replaced by another. And this is why I think there's some sort of a transportation device there, that it has the ability to transform perhaps the human body or the human soul into a being of light capable of traveling to another dimension.
All right. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with William Henry. Good morning.
Good morning.
Where are you, pray tell?
Spokane,
Washington, KGA. All right.
Yes. My name is Judd. Very, very important program tonight, Art and William.
Yeah.
I just want to quote a couple of quick verses from the first chapter of Genesis I never hear anybody quote. And the 26th verse, which supports what you're saying, I think, somewhat, William, it says, "And God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness."
The plural.
And then it clarifies it in the 27th when it says, "So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him, male and female created he them." Why this is overlooked in theology, I do not understand, but it shows that God was dealing with some kind of a contemporary intelligence.
It's not overlooked. I beg to differ. It's something you trip over if you're at all astute, and then you begin to look into it, and you begin to look within at the esoteric meaning of that term and what that actually represents, and then you're first terrified, then you're enlightened.
All right. On that note, we're going to take a break, and then when we come back, I have a question for William about reincarnation. Dear Art, I'm very disturbed that you compared William with Patsy. Well, I didn't, actually. But going on, this is one of the cruelest remarks I've ever heard from you. There are two forces in the universe, the duality, love and fear. Patsy obviously was attuned to fear the voice of the devil. Fear's work is to destroy. William's belief may not be anything you understand. That does not mean he is of the devil. I certainly did not mean to suggest that he was. This is Loretta writing. So if that's what you thought, Loretta, then you misinterpreted what I said. What I said was that Patsy would like listening to my guest, William, because she would perceive him as misled, I believe. And this is reflected in another fact. Dear Art, William is very accurately describing what the Bible calls the false prophet. The only problem is that the false prophet comes to precede the Antichrist, who is a peacemaker for a period of time. In fact, he is exactly the Antichrist's ability to solve the Middle East fight, the one over Jerusalem, which wins him the term peacemaker. But that peace does not last. So that is the reference that I made to Patsy, that Patsy would have surely accused William of mistaking what he believes to be the peacemaker for the Antichrist. Do you understand what I'm saying, William?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Okay, I was not saying that you were of the devil or analogous to Patsy in any way.
Art, you're too much a gentleman to do that. There's no way I even interpret it that way. I understood what you meant and took it to heart. It is an enormously complex issue. I think if I have a message for anybody that's listening tonight, no matter which side of the line they perceive themselves to be on, It just may be that now is the time for the reenactment of this mystery play. And indeed, it is a carefully scripted mystery play.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the reason why you're such a tower of strength in our culture right now, because you're the lone voice in the wilderness. You're giving a ray of hope to people. You're assembling people, the children of light, perhaps some children of darkness, asking them to be responsible for who they are and what we're doing with our world.
William, I have not solidified my faith in anything beyond this life that I can touch and understand and prove. And that's, of course, my problem. But I am open to listening to all and to considering all. Now, here's one more, Art, more ignition material. I love that, quote, Tower of Babel, end quote, routine. Now, what was God afraid of? Again, no big mystery, simply a unification of the human race on Earth. This theme was further backed up by revelations in the warnings of a New World Order. God forbid that mankind would reach the level of personal growth that would permit this kind of unity.
Yeah.
People of Earth, we have been conned. Get off your knees and walk with dignity and respect for each other and all living things that a creator would have desired. How's that?
Well, we've turned this evening into an encounter group for Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
Sitchin makes an emphatic point that Yahweh is in fact psychotic. He has a split personality, and this is explained by the fact that it's actually two different God beings in conflict with one another. One, a beneficial type being who wishes us to completely and utterly become godlike beings, and another being who ruthlessly withholds anything that would remotely enable us to challenge the gods. In the Sumerian tradition, they appear as Enki and Enlil. And this is used by many to explain the dichotomy of Yahweh. On the one hand, he treats us like slaves, but on the other hand, he gives us the Ten Commandments, which are supposed to be these lovingly, crafted sort of laws by which we can live on, which are actually plagiarized from the Egyptian Book of the Dead. There's absolutely nothing original about this figure whatsoever.
So then your view would be the Ten Commandments were not received and carried down by Moses upon tablets.
There's no way that's a Sunday school story. That's
Sunday
a fairy tale.
Okay. All right. First time caller line. You're on the air with William Henry. Hi.
Yes. Hi. How you doing?
I'm fine.
Yes, Mr. Henry. How are you?
Very good, sir. How are you?
Good. I'm doing fine by the grace of God as well. That's something I want. There's a couple of questions I would like to ask you. But before I do, I would like to really get an understanding of this. What you're saying is that this peacemaker will be present before the return of the Messiah?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, are we living in the last days?
Ah, good question.
Well, yeah, it's a great question. Yes,
okay.
We're living at the end of a 26,000-year cosmic
cycle. Okay.
Well, let him answer.
So we agree with that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if we're living in last days, then Messiah is bound to return, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so where is this peacemaker?
Have you been to the movies lately?
No.
A lot of people like to talk that we're being prepared and peppered by these movies and the latest Air Force kicks the crap out of the aliens movie and so forth. Did you notice that there was a movie that came out recently called The Peacemaker?
Okay, well...
And my point is that if we are being misled, that this is how we are being misled. The Peacemaker is presented in this film as an action hero who tracks down black market nuclear materials.
Okay.
Whether you perceive him as a Christ or Antichrist,
mm-hmm.
This figure has absolutely nothing to do with the portrayal of that movie, yet you have millions of people on Earth believing that the Peacemaker is this action hero.
Okay, well, see, I'm dealing with a math. See, one and one is two. Now, what I'm saying is that we're living in the last days, and Christ is bound to return. Now, if the Christ is bound to return, then where's the peacemaker? Where's the peacemaker present? And if that one is here, who is he, and where is he at? You understand where I'm coming from?
Yeah.
Well,
right.
That's a question. Who is he, and where is he now? Well, if I've been listening properly, he is either here now, or will be here very shortly, or will appear as a completely grown mortal.
Yes, and I hope you'll read my book, because a good clue to the answer is found in the book.
Okay. Do you have a radio on in the background? We've somehow lost you. I'm not sure what's going on here. Are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, okay. You are there. All right. Good.
Yes.
Wildcard line, you're on the air with William Henry. Hello.
Yes, Mr. Henry. This is Gloria from Las Vegas.
Gloria, I can barely hear you. You're going to have to yell at us.
Oh, my goodness. Have you got a poor connection or what?
That's better now.
Yes. I wanted to talk to you about the ancient doctrine of Amun of Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
Let me see now. The Egyptians called the all-in-all the Ament. And the Amun is the first witness to come forth from the darkness. It's the first center of consciousness. And this center of consciousness creates ray by vibration.
Mm-hmm.
And this is how the universe and everything began. This center of consciousness is in every atom and every being.
Right. Yeah, I think it's wonderful that we finally wound around back to the beginning of our conversation, which 3 hours ago.
Yes.
I wanted to state that there's actually a prophecy that was nailed to the cross.